it's kind of right on topic. I wanted to talk about, been talking for a while on the Eightfold Path, and we started talking about the four foundations of mindfulness, so we're still talking about mindfulness practice, and tonight I'm going to talk about the, they're called the five aggregates, which can sound like, well, first of all, it sounds really foreign and alien to me. I think of like construction when I think of aggregate. I don't really know what aggregate is, right? Looking into, I think it can be helpful to come to a group like this because we can start to discuss, right? And we can develop insight by discussing and by learning. You know, the Buddha was a systems thinker and he offered a bunch of maps to the human experience. Not as belief systems or, you know, like that this is the way things are, but this is a map of things to look at for yourself. You know, like the four foundations of mindfulness. Here is a, let's look into the body sensations. Let's look into feeling impressions. Let's look into mind states. Right, and then the fourth foundation is the contemplation of dhammas, which I'll talk about what that is. But the first thing I want to say is that, you know, like the first insight that I had when I came to Against the Stream is I remember coming and sitting down, and I came, I think we all come for a few different reasons. I came because I was suffering pretty badly. I'd always been interested in Buddhism, and I thought that the Dalai Lama looked happy. I thought that Thich Nhat Hanh looked happy. I thought that the Buddha looked calm, right? And I wanted that. You know, I wanted to look like that or feel like that. And so I remember sitting down and hearing the instruction, as we often do, to put aside, to set the intention, to put aside, as the Buddha said, our desire and discontent in regard to the world. So to put down the grocery list of planning and to put down all of the things I have to get done this week and all of my regrets of the thing that I said to the person that I shouldn't have said, and right, and all of these things. And to allow myself the opportunity to just breathe and just to be present and grounded in my body. And the first insight I had was that I couldn't do it, right? And I feel like it was one of the most powerful insights I had because, you know, I heard my teacher say, put all of the shit down for a little bit, and I realized I was completely addicted to my mind. I was completely, you know, just really just paid attention to whatever came up on the screen. It's like a thought, a plan, a, you know, and so my first experience meditating was a lot of restlessness, a lot of distraction. And then the second insight I had is as I practiced a little bit, as I kept coming here and I decided to start practicing a little bit at home on and off, I started to be able to train my attention a little bit and to realize that I could, for a moment maybe at a time, feel into my breath, listen to sounds, right? Establish a ground. And for that second, it was like I got to drop out of all of the restlessness and distraction and plans and, you know, self-identity and all of the stuff that was just plaguing my mind. And I got to break my addiction to the mind for a moment and be able to, and it felt really good. It was relieving. You know, to tell my mind, not right now, I'm not going to do this right now. And it wouldn't listen long and it would come back. But that practice, right? And then I started to have some faith and some confidence that maybe if I continued to practice in this way and I continued, that I could then develop more of a relationship to my mind. Instead of having to react from my mind all the time, I could relate to it. Not that I could get rid of it, right? I wanted to get rid of it. That's really what I wanted when I came here. But I couldn't get rid of it. But I started to develop a little bit of space. you know? And I feel like, you know, mindfulness is really, it's a science of attention training. We know in neuroscience that whatever we pay attention to gets bigger. The Buddha said, manasikara, yanaso manasikara means careful attention, but manasikara, attention, means making in the mind. So whatever we pay attention to, it gets made in the mind. And so he said, well, let's be really careful about what we're paying attention to. And not meaning that I need to not pay attention or always, like, try to dodge all of my painful emotions. Actually, it's a very bad idea, right? But to also be full of care with what I pay attention to. So being able to acknowledge the pain, right? Acknowledge the fear, to let it in, to feel it, and to care for it with my attention. Right? Think about, like, I think about a lot of times when I'm in a lot of pain, mostly what I want is someone to be present with me, right? I want someone to listen, someone to, like, when I think of caring for me, it's like a willingness to be with me. And so can I start to do this for all of the parts of myself that ordinarily I don't want to fuck with, right? I don't want to confront the fear. I don't want to care for the fear. I want to get rid of it. And so this was a huge insight for me because I felt like I was given an opportunity to, one, feel, you know, I'd always had this feeling that I was doing it wrong, like I was doing life wrong. I would look at other people, I'd look at, like I said, with the Buddha, and I'd look at everyone's external appearance, and I'd be like, something's wrong in here, right? Because the insides don't match their outsides at all. And so it was really normalizing to hear the teaching and to hear the Buddha talk about stress, and that stress is an inherent part of life, and that fear and that sorrow and lamentation, all these things are a part of what we experience as humans, and that it's actually completely normal. And that could I start to relate to these parts, you know, these things that are painful and that are challenging. And for me, like, start to also learn to embrace things like excitement and joy and appreciate. I always had this fear that, you know, if I was grateful or appreciated something, it's like this superstitious or obsessive kind of, it's like, then it's going to go away. And the Buddha was like, yeah, it is going to go away, but can you be with what's also enjoyable and pleasant? So establishing and practicing with attention and learning to check in and to check in by experience, by just, you know, and that's why I always say I feel like in the Buddha talked about mindfulness being, you know, a warning quality is it's not anything special. I've had moments where I've been present and I've known, you know, I'm really tripping right now about something, right? Mindfulness, bam. Working with attention and starting to learn some of the Buddhist discourse, starting to learn some of the maps that he outlined. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness, it's sometimes called contemplation of dhammas, is really where it's categories of phenomena, which sounds crazy. But basically, it's where I take some of these teachings and some of these maps that are offered, and I start to, as I sit, see if I can look for them. And a couple weeks ago, I talked about the hindrances of noticing craving, aversion, restlessness, sleepiness, doubt. I think this can be normalizing too, because again, this isn't anything unique, right? I feel like almost all of us, at least three or four of the hindrances, we could say yes, definitely experience those regularly, right? Craving, aversion, restlessness, sleepiness, doubt. And the next piece that we're contemplating is the aggregates, which can sound like a very... this teaching can come across as like expert-level Dharma. And I don't think that that was ever the Buddha's intention, so I'm going to try my best to make this relatable. The aggregates is basically, I would say, how the Buddha outlines our psychology. So how the interconnectedness of body, heart, and mind, you could say, from a more traditional perspective, right? How our mind and emotional, right? Sometimes in Eastern tradition, actually in the Pali Canon, we call this the heart mind. That the heart and the mind are not separate; that they're connected, they're interconnected. And so the aggregates are the system. It's the map for how we start to explore how our heart and mind are interconnected. How we're very sensitive beings. How we're affected by the world. And the five, I'll go through them, are form, feeling, perception, inclination, and consciousness. And the way I like to lay out and outline the aggregates is looking at this idea that we are, you know, we have five senses, we have a mind, and that we are, I feel like, meant to, and we have a nervous system, we are meant to be very empathetic, we are meant to be very sensitive, right? We're stimulated constantly by our environments. And so in form, what we talk about, or materiality sometimes it's called, we're talking about the elements, the physical form, you sometimes call body, of just the I like to call the sensorium or the sensate body that we have. Our senses are located in a form. And as we make contact through our senses with the world, seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing, feeling. I think I missed one. You know what they are. The five we learned in kindergarten, right? As we make contact with the world, you know, that's how consciousness arises. So consciousness is nothing crazy. The Buddha actually doesn't really define it that much. Really, he just says that there are conditions that give rise to consciousness. Just being awake, being online. There's seeing consciousness and smelling consciousness and tasting and hearing and feeling consciousness. And that consciousness is not a noun, it's a verb. It's moment to moment. I'm being bombarded, my senses are being bombarded, and I'm connecting with all of these different parts of what's happening. And as I make contact with the world through my senses, a few things kind of pop out of making contact. We have feeling impression, we have perception, and we have inclinations. Kind of, they all come as a package. And so if you've been coming for a while, you know that the Buddha was talked about, one of his main teachings is about, it's usually phrased as dependent origination, but it's really dependent co-arising, that really as things happen, that they kind of, conditions create more conditions, is a way to say that. So, for example, I'm sitting and I'm meditating and I have just some random thought about, you know, this guy named Joe that I went to school with. And I think about this purple shirt that he used to always wear, and then I think about, shit, I'm going out of town later. I gotta get some shirts. Right, I wonder what the weather's like in New Mexico. Right? So just contact with that thought, it creates more thoughts, right? Simple enough. And so as I make contact and my attention land somewhere, I feel some type of way, right? I'm affected. There's some kind of impression. Feeling or feeling tone, the Pali word is vedana. What we mean here is basically the primary sense of likes and dislikes. So this isn't like an emotion, it's just the basic sense of when I make contact with something, there's an impression that's conditioned in. Right? See, Zubi, pleasant feeling, friend, right? And also, you see, the perception comes. I know him. I can look at him. I see his shape, who he is. I have a bunch of memory with perception. That comes as a package. So our perception's all based on memory and things that have happened. This is really interesting, right? And this is where we really start to get in trouble between feeling and perception, is because I can, you know, meet someone for the first time. I talk about this at one of the treatment centers that I work at for substance abuse treatment. And I talk about, like, how someone can come in, they're detoxing from heroin, right? And they come in on their first day and you meet them and they're a complete asshole. They're just, like, cussing and they're saying, like, they start saying it's, like, your fault that they're there. And you're like, I don't even know. Right, I don't even know what's happening right now. This guy's crazy. He's nuts. I'm going to stay away from him. And so there were a lot of conditions that created this guy's behavior, and I was the recipient of that. So my perception of this guy is that he's an asshole. He's a dick, right? I don't want to talk to this guy again. And so as a result, I'm inclined, and we'll talk about inclination, I'm inclined to not sit next to him when he comes to the cafeteria. Right? And when he tries to make eye contact with me, I dismiss. Right? I avoid. I'm inclined to. And so the next time I see him after this experience, perception comes online. I know him. Unpleasant feeling. Dislike. And then I'm inclined to avoid. And so around unpleasant, of course, what happens is around unpleasant feeling is I am inclined to resist, to avoid, to dislike, to hate, to not want. This can be really problematic because then I start talking to this guy or I overhear him and he's talking about the same music that I like and I get a little closer and I listen in. And then he starts talking about where he's from. He's from the same town that I grew up in, and he went to the same school. And I'm like, whatever, he's still an asshole, right? I start listening a little more, and he starts crying and telling a story about his mother to one of the counselors. And all of a sudden it's like, oh, I have this new understanding. And so where the Buddha talked about perception really becoming a problem is when we have fixed views. Any of this is a problem, but that when we start to fix our views. Because then I don't allow the opportunity and the option to reconsider, right? And to maybe say, oh, you know, now all of a sudden this unpleasant went to mildly unpleasant. And then I talk to him and we have a lot in common. And then, you know, and so this is really important. To look at, this is really important to experience and to open, to become aware of moment to moment how we're very affected by our world. And continuing to talk about feeling for a little bit, one of the things that we know in neuroscience is that we are wired for what they call a negativity bias. And so we are actually hyper-aware or a little more often than not attuned to what is unpleasant and what we don't like and what's uncomfortable and what we are annoyed or irritated by in this moment. Right? For survival, it makes sense that my brain and nervous system's job is to try to make me be comfortable all the time. And so I push away unpleasant, and I try to avoid it. I always try to get in there. I'm inclined to try to fix and manage and control the conditions to make them just right. If I can get it just right, then I'll be good. It creates a sense of, like, craving, too, and craving after pleasure, pleasant feeling. So there's unpleasant, there's pleasant, and then there's neither. And when things are neither pleasant or unpleasant, I usually tend towards boredom. It's like, fuck this, right? I want some chaos in my life or something, right? I want something. Just sitting there, it's like, can I, you know, but with more and more practice, allowing some neutral experiences to be good enough. Can I let this moment right now be good enough? So in feeling, where we're talking about the aggregates, because the Buddha talks about stress comes from clinging to the aggregates as self. So I'll break this down a little bit. Stress comes from clinging to form, our body, feeling, perception, inclination, consciousness as self, that I am this feeling, this perception, this inclination, that it's my fault. When really these are just the conditions that are hitting us every moment, contact, feeling, perception, inclination. Unpleasant, don't want. Pleasant, want. And we really start to get in trouble, as I was saying before, around perception, because this is where we fix our strongly held beliefs and our views about our place in the world. Stephen Batchelor talks about this as, you know, the dukkha or the stress that's created from taking up a stance against other. So sometimes dukkha or stress is described as an innate sense of feeling separate from the other. We get really internalized, and we get into our own thoughts, feelings, and emotions, into these aggregate experience, and we start to really feel isolated in that. You know, that this means something about me, and that, like, I am fixed, and that I am, you know, I'm not good enough, or I'm, on the other extreme, I'm the best, right? Which also creates a fair bit of suffering. You know, like even looking at perception around, you know, one week I gave the best Dharma talk ever, right? It's like, oh, I'm pretty good at this shit. You know? I've kind of arrived, I kind of landed, I know all the stuff now, and now I can just freestyle it, I got it. Go on the next week, tank, right? It's like, fuck, man, I don't even, and really, you know, like, this is the type of thing that can really take over. It's like, I'm not good enough, I don't have a good enough practice, I should sit more, I should go on more retreats. We even do this when we're sitting. It's like, I nailed that meditation, right? Mm-hmm. I was completely with every breath, every sensation. Next time we come in, it's like completely distracted. Fuck. The self, right? The self makes its way into even spiritual practice. So feeling, contact, feeling, perception, inclination is the to-do mind. It's as I make contact and I feel pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, I have some conditioned perception of what... who Zuby is, or what this person is, or the situation, then given that information, I'm inclined to react. Our habitual reaction is to do the obvious, to avoid unpleasant, to crave and cling to pleasant, or to have delusion, right? A lot of self, which is what we're talking about. And this is where intention becomes such an important part of Buddhist practice, is moment to moment, as I'm present as I am engaged in the moment, I can start to bring, I have an opportunity to bring a quality of renunciation, of kindness, of compassion. I have an opportunity to bring some generosity where I would normally crave and want. My friend made pork tenderloin the other night, and they're cutting out, like, the pieces, and I was, like, trying to get there first, you know, to get the best piece, because I was really hungry. It's like, I have an opportunity in every moment to kind of check that, and it's like, it's fine. There's no value judgment about whether I get the bigger piece of meat or not. But it's just a quality of that whatever one thinks and ponders upon becomes the inclination of the mind. That's what the Buddha said. So that I create mental habits. That by acting on craving, I'm more likely to act on craving again. By acting on hatred or aversion or resisting what's painful, I'm more likely to do that again. By avoiding the unpleasant things in my life, I'm more likely to do that again. And that it's all not personal. This is just what comes with being born into this world, with being born with a nervous system and a brain that wants security. I want permanence. I want things to be lasting and secure. And the Buddha kind of flipped it all on its head and he said, it's not, though. They sometimes call this practice like starting to embody or be present with the groundless ground. It's like the feeling of jumping out of an airplane and then realizing you have no parachute. Right? But then you're falling and falling and falling, and after you practice more and more and get acclimated to uprooting the self, that you realize there's no ground, right? That you're just falling, and can you fall gracefully? Can you fall with some kindness and with some compassion, knowing that everyone else here is falling too? That we all feel insecure, that we all want to establish our position in the world. That I want you to like me. Right? That I want to be safe. And that we go about, if we're not present for this, the inclination can be automatic and reactive instead of responsive. If I don't take the time to be present, I just act out of habit, out of what feels good. And for a lot of us that are in recovery, what feels good is extremely harmful. And we can hit bottom a lot of times, and sometimes the worst thing is when we don't, right? When we stay in the relationship for 3 or 4 years, when we continue to act on the behaviors or whatever it may be, when we don't hit bottom, it's like, and we continue to be asleep to all of these habits. And so I'm going to backpedal a little bit and talk to the other end of this, and also, like, I'm going to continue to act on the same habits, because they're habits, they're strong. That's why this place is called Against the Stream. Stephen Batchelor talks about Buddhist practice needing to be turbulent. Jack Kornfield says something like, if you don't cry, like, I don't know, every other time you meditate or something, you need to try harder. I don't cry every time I meditate, but... Right, that there is some turbulence, that it is challenging to confront our most deep habits, inclinations. My last option to this day, and I said this last time, is like when I feel pain, is to feel the pain. It's like the last thing maybe it's gotten a little bit better, but it's still, I'll go through all the other things that I can do. And then finally I'm like, fuck, all right. I'm scared, right? And be with that. And so forgiveness becomes a really important part of getting back on our spiritual path. Like, it's, I am tired of doing things the right way, trying to do things the right way, be the good Buddhist, or like, you know. My teacher always tells me, and I always try to do things the right way, and he always tells me and reminds me that you can't outsmart suffering, right? But I got to go through, I got to embrace, I got to be present for, and that will take a lot of forgiveness, because I will fuck up more often than not. In some areas. And in some areas, I'll have a lot of success. Also, the last thing I'll talk about is that we also do need to have a self. That there is no, this is not personal. That these are just a combination of conditions coming together. And that there can be deep insight into the impersonal nature of human life. But that it would be entirely confusing and weird if I sat up here and referred to myself as Andrew. Or the one who calls himself Andrew. The aggregates whom are known as Andrew. Right? We have a relational self. We want to live from our authentic self. I'm all about the self. We want to have an integrated and contained self. If we get too into, like, I'm going to just be not self all the time, we're unglued and completely unable to function in the world. I think there are some Zen hermits that went to caves to go doing that work, that type of work, if you want to do that work. And so how do I allow myself to be fluid? How do I let Andrew change when I need to change? Right? When certain parts of my identity aren't serving me anymore. I noticed this when I started applying for jobs. I couldn't just, like, yell at my boss, right? I couldn't get my way. I had to start the adolescent part of myself that was like, this system's fucked, man. Like, you know, like, that didn't work with me trying to work at this job, right? Make money. And so it's like, okay, I need to re-examine this self. I need to let that change, let that shift. I feel like I made it through all right. It's a hard topic. So I mostly would love to hear some discussion. So we have 15 minutes. Your personal experience, anything that resonated with you, and the floor is open.